Welcome and thank you very much for joining us on episode 96 of the Blazers Edge podcast, presented to you today by BlazersEdge.com. I'm your weekend host, Chris Lucia. If you need to get a hold of us at the show, please do so anytime by emailing us at BlazersEdgePodcast@gmail.com. And don't forget, you can rate, review, and subscribe to the Blazers Edge podcast on Stitcher and iTunes. Joining me on the Blazers Edge weekend podcast today is Blazers Edge staff writer Eric Griffith. Eric, how's it going, man?
I'm doing pretty well. How are you doing, Chris?
I'm doing great. It's, you have been on the front page of BlazersEdge.com quite a bit this week. I think you've had, two previews this week. You had an article on Thursday, and you're here on the weekend podcast now. So how's it feel to be Blazers Edge's busiest man?
It feels pretty awesome, actually. I'm really enjoying the, I guess you call it, multi-platform approach to reporting.
Yeah, that's an interesting designation, Blazers Edge's busiest man. But, like I said, it seems like you've been around, the front page quite a bit this week. And on the podcast today, one thing I really wanted to go over, because I think it kind of turned a few heads and it kind of shifted or tilted a little bit, maybe some of the conversation that we've had around the starting backcourt for the Trailblazers. So let's go ahead. I want to give you an opportunity, Eric, to talk about the article that you put out on Thursday that was talking about the playing time between Damian Lillard and CJ McCollum.
Yeah, so Casey Holdale, the Blazers in-house reporter who runs the blog ForwardCenter.net, ran a piece, I think it was on Monday or Sunday last week, where he mentioned that Damian Lillard and CJ McCollum have been on the court together quite a bit, and more importantly, they've only been sitting at the same time for maybe 12 or 13 minutes all season. So basically, Dame or CJ is always in the game no matter what. And Terry Stotts does that by design. And so my article was looking into, the beginning of the article was looking into, okay, why is he doing that? What's going on that he needs one of those two players? And the bottom line is that CJ and Dame are really the only two ball handlers, and they're the only two guys who can initiate the offense, and they're the only two guys who can score on their own. So if one of them isn't in the game and the offense gets shut down, the flow for some reason gets disrupted, there's going to be no plan B, because suddenly you have someone like Alan Crabb, who is a great shooter, does really well in the flow with Dame or CJ, but he can't create his own shot. He has literally zero assisted three-pointers in the last two seasons, or unassisted three-pointers in the last two seasons. And what that means is that every three-pointer he has made has been on a pass from some other player.
Well, that's because Cool Breeze is the number one team player. He's always playing for the team, man. He's not playing for himself. He's taking passes from teammates, not pulling up off the dribble,
Well, yeah, and you need guys like that, because you end up otherwise you end up with five Jamal Crawfords or five James Hardens, and that's not going to go well. There's only one ball. So you definitely need guys like that. But at the same time, you can't have five Allen Crabbs in the game. Right. And I think that's the balance, and that's why Terry Stotts always wants CJ or Damian in the game, because he needs someone who's going to be able to create some offense, someone who's going to be able to go one-on-one and break down a defender and create open looks for the other players.
Yeah, it's certainly indicative that the stat about Crabb is that he needs guys around him that are going to take away the attention of the opposition, of the defense, in order for him to get those open assisted looks that he does get when he's on the court, next to a guy like Damian or CJ or both at the same time. I think if you look up and down the board, the off-court, on-court numbers are going to be fairly consistent with the guys who are playing with Dame and with CJ. The whole offense as a whole just functions better with those guys on the court for the reasons that you listed. Now, going back to the article, some of the things that you cited, you actually went a little deeper with some of the statistics, with some of the on-court, off-court numbers. Did you discover anything interesting between those numbers when Dame's off the floor or when CJ's off the floor, how they affect each other and the way they play off each other?
Yeah, so I was kind of interested in seeing how the game changes when only one of those two players, when only Damian Lillard or only CJ McCollum is on the floor. And so I just real quick ran the on-off numbers for both players. And what I found really, really surprised me. I figured they would become maybe a little bit more inefficient, but generally they'd still be very effective at scoring. The numbers showed, though, that when Damian Lillard is not in the game, CJ McCollum's shooting falls off a cliff. He just becomes incredibly inefficient. His three-point shooting goes from 42% to 28%. His effective field goal percentage goes from 0.534 to 0.391. He's shooting under 40% without Damian in the game. Basically, he becomes someone who is putting up a lot of shots and not a lot of them are going down.
So what does this fly in the face of the conventional wisdom that a lot of Blazer fans kind of had, or the kind of accepted storyline with McCollum being able to create his own shot? Does this kind of fly in the face of that to you at all?
I think it flies in the face of him being able to create his own shot to a certain extent. It seems like he's still, you know, getting a shot up. He's not doing it very well. And he's still someone who can handle the ball well and get around a defender. And so I think we need to be a little more selective with when we start to talk about CJ McCollum and really make a distinction between getting his own shot accurately and getting good shots for other players. Because I think he's definitely improved at getting good shots for other players, but it may be that he's still not ready to take that next step where he can also score himself.
So I guess what's kind of the takeaway here with these, because they're pretty extreme, I think, on different ends of the spectrum here, in terms of with Lillard on the floor and with Lillard not on the floor. You mentioned the field goal percentage goes from 45.6 to 35.4, 3-point, 41.6 to 27.5. The effective field goal percentage drops precipitously as well. I mean, it's a very stark and clear contrast for McCollum on the floor when Lillard's not on the floor. So I guess is there anything that we can take away with a sample size of 23 games? Or is this something that we're going to have to let play out a little more of this season? Do you think this is kind of a quirk, or is there something that we can really kind of take away from this that we can say pretty much for certain that we know from these statistics?
So I'd say, you know, step number one is this a sampling error? And I would say almost certainly not after this point. CJ's played a lot of minutes. He's put up a lot of, you know, he's put up 147 shots without Lillard, 237 with Lillard. I think that's enough shots to say it's not a sampling error at this point. What's interesting to me is that when you look at the shot chart, though, when you look at the heat map, he's getting his shots in different ways when Lillard's on the court versus when Lillard is off the court. When Lillard's off the court, CJ's taking a lot of mid-range jumpers on the left side, and his three-point shooting is much more focused above the break, which means above the free throw line extended. Whereas when Lillard's in the game, he's pretty much shooting only in specific spots on the arc, the corners a lot, and he's shooting a ton around the rim, very little mid-range game. What this says to me is that it says that CJ's probably scoring a lot of points when Lillard's out of the game on the pick and roll. That's where he's getting those mid-range shots. He's getting a pick. He's going into the middle. The defense isn't letting him get all the way, and he's having to pull up for a mid-range jumper, which isn't the greatest shot in basketball, and that may be why his percentages are going down. It also means that he's probably getting more defensive pressure. Damian Lillard is probably drawing that double team, and CJ is benefiting from it, whereas when Damian's out of the game, now CJ is the guy getting double teamed, and so he's getting shut down.
Do you think that when CJ McCollum is on the floor controlling the offense, based on the eyeball test alone, I guess, the stats, I'm not sure if they would confirm this or not, but do you think he becomes a bit more of, and you use this term in your article, chucker at all? Does it seem like he may be passing up looks for his teammates and taking maybe more contested shots himself? And, you know, I'm speaking about CJ McCollum.
I haven't, you know, honestly, I hadn't been watching him that close, but from when I have been paying close attention to CJ without Damian on the court, I don't think he necessarily is becoming a chucker. I think what's happening is the offense isn't running as smoothly, and when, like I said, when plan A gets shut down and CJ now becomes plan B, he has to shoot the ball because there's no one else for him to really give the ball to. And so as a result, he is getting a disproportionate number of the low quality looks, of the inefficient shots that come towards the end of the shot clock or come after option A and B have been shut down of the passing offense, the Stotts runs. And so I don't know that it's that he's a chucker. I think it's that he's getting more of the pressure on him. And then the follow up to that is that since he's not yet as adept at running the offense and he's not as much of a threat as Lillard, he's going to have to take contested shots more often than Lillard does when Lillard's running the offense alone.
Now, what kind of solutions here can Stotts kind of employ in the long term in order for the team to be able to have success when Damian Lillard is not on the court? Because it's pretty clear when you look at the on-court, off-court numbers. Not only do CJ McCollum's numbers suffer, but offensively, a lot of the other players on the team suffer as well. And you know, that's there's going to be a lot of things that can vary those stats or can affect those statistics. One thing is considering the opposition that they're playing against. So Damian's going to be playing against, more starters, and other guys are going to be playing with fewer starters. That's always going to affect things. The pace of the game might change with Lillard off the court. So some of those aggregate stats are certainly going to change. I mean, there's a number of variables that play into this, but it seems like the team plays, and this is kind of the no dust statement of the night, but they play out significantly better with Lillard on the floor. But he's a guy who's, I think the last couple of years, he's been in the top five, at least the top 10 in minutes per game, right? And so at some point, you know, he's not going to be able to be playing 37 minutes a night. At least I don't think in the long term that's the best solution. So what, you know, can the Blazers do for maybe those 12 minutes to 15 minutes a night when Damian's off the floor? Are there any solutions that you can see now in the short term and maybe further on in the long run for this?
You know, I just noticed the stat with Damian and CJ, and it really, as I was writing the article 2 days ago, and it really made me start to think about that exact question. And I started to wonder if Terry Stotts has already started to adjust for that, because I'm sure he knows that CJ is not shooting efficiently when Damian's not in the game. You know, he's the head coach. He has to have noticed by now. And I wonder if that's one of the hidden reasons why Myers-Leonard has not yet returned to the starting lineup. I wonder if Stotts is already adjusting the lineup to try to make it so Leonard's playing more often when CJ or Damian are on the court alone. And I wonder that because Myers is, you know, he's no LaMarcus Aldridge as far as creating his own shot. You can't just dump the ball to him in the high post and say, go do your thing, Myers. He's not at that level yet. However, he's still able to do some things on offense that other players on the team are not quite there yet with. You know, he has that new move where he does a face-up dribble, he moves and makes a sweeping hook shot across the middle of the key. He can shoot a three-pointer when he's open, of course. He can do some stuff passing on the perimeter to find an open man. Maybe he'll be the second or third pass in the offense, and so new opportunities will have arisen based on the cuts that are happening around him as he's drug the bigger defender out of the lane. And so I'm starting to wonder if Myers-Leonard's playing later in the first quarter and into the second quarter so that CJ and Damian have a little bit of extra help when they're in the game alone.
Yeah, it seems like Terry Stotts is kind of a fan of the staggered lineup, I guess is how it would be framed. You know, in the past, you've noticed when a starter gets injured, he doesn't immediately promote the second unit backup to the starting lineup. He'll take somebody like in the past, he took Myers-Leonard, who hadn't been starting at all. He hadn't even been playing hardly. I think when LaMarcus was hurt, was it for a couple games? And Leonard started in place of him, who was otherwise outside of the rotation to kind of preserve that second unit. And you saw that, I think, last year when Nick Batum was hurt and you had Alan Crabb inserted into the lineup. Again, that was a thing where AC was pretty much out of the rotation effectively until Batum got hurt, and then he started starting in place of him, and it allowed Terry Stotts to have his same second unit. So do you think this staggering is just this kind of, it's kind of a method that Stotts uses to make sure that there's, you know, an appropriate amount of offense and an appropriate amount of floor spacing on the court at all times for the Blazers? Is this something you've noticed as well?
Yeah, and I think Stotts does a really good job of identifying the strengths, and I've said this before on the podcast, but Stotts is a pro at identifying the strengths of the players and figuring out who plays well together and then maximizing the potential of any one lineup. And so I definitely think he has continued to do that with CJ and with Damian, and I think we'll see more of that with the experimenting where he finds the guys who are most able to complement Damian or CJ when they're on the court alone. And, you know, really make up for the fact that the offense really only has one shot creator so that it doesn't end up stagnated and end up incredibly inefficient.
You talked about Myers-Leonard being in that second unit or, you know, playing when one of those guys is on the court alone to kind of alleviate some of the pressure. And you mentioned a variety of his shots that he's kind of been working on this year. And also pulling the big out of the paint creates open looks inside, or I should say easier looks for guys like Dame and CJ who like to drive the ball and finish at the rim.
Well, it also opens up cutters too, because now Myers has developed, you know, a lot of passing skill. And so when you have him with the ball out there, you know, on the perimeter, and suddenly there's a center or power forward guarding him, that lane frees up for someone to run through it and then take a nice backdoor pass from Myers. And we've seen a ton of that action, both with him and Plumlee, actually, all season.
So that's kind of what you've seen, the Band-Aid, I guess. I don't know if that's the proper way to phrase that, but that's kind of been the alleviation of the issue of having one of those guys on the court and having the defense really focused down on him has been using Myers Leonard in kind of staggered minutes with those two players. But is there any other solution to this, or is there anything, I don't know if I should say solution, but is there any ideas that we have to throw out that, you know, maybe come from the small forward position or the backcourt that could help these guys when they're playing on the court alone without each other?
You talking about Allen Crabbe?
I'm not implying anything. I wouldn't be upset to see Allen Crabbe get more minutes in the starting lineup. I'm just wondering if you have. Sorry, I shouldn't have made those terms so vague. Is there a solution that you can see for Terry Stotts to employ that would kind of come from the backcourt? And by this I mean Gerald Henderson, Tim Frazier. Yes, Cole Breeze could be potentially included in your response to that. switching up Al-Farouq Aminu's minutes. Do you see any other things that Stotts could kind of throw at opposing defenses there?
Honestly, and maybe I'm thinking too far inside the box right now, but I really don't. Maybe Henderson, you know, he's an accomplished player and he's pretty, you know, he's very competent. He's not a primary ball handler, but he can dribble. So maybe as Henderson ends up in better shape, and maybe he'll eventually become that guy. But his outside shot is just so inaccurate, and it doesn't seem to get better, at least as far as I've noticed, when he's open. So I don't see him as becoming that guy. And so I honestly don't know if there's anyone on the roster who can fill that role. And to me, that says this offseason the Blazers almost have to go after another guard or another small forward in the Nick Batum mold, who can handle the ball, be a primary ball, a primary offense initiator, and also shoot well. And what would happen if they have that third creator to play with Lillard and with McCollum is that, again, Stotts could stagger the minutes so that two of those guys, Lillard, McCollum, and mystery third player, are always in the game together. And then that would prevent that fall off we're seeing with CJ's stats right now, that he would never be in a situation where he's the only creator, where he's the only guy who can get a shot off in the mid-range, and where his field goal percentage just drops off a cliff.
Was this similar to a few seasons ago when you had Mo Williams on the team backing up Damian Lillard kind of as the combo point, and then Nick Batum would kind of turn into that kind of offense initiator at times when he was or turn into more of a facilitator when he was on the floor with one of those guys alone? Is that something similar to what you're kind of saying there?
Yes, exactly. And I think someone in that Nick Batum role would fit really well with Damian and CJ. And, you know, it's the really depressing thing about that to me, and I know everyone hates it when we dwell on the past, but I think CJ was literally supposed to fill the Mo Williams role last season, and that's why Neil O'Shea got only Steve Blake and he didn't get another guy who could score the ball off the bench. I think he was expecting McCollum to make the jump he's making right now last year and be that difference maker for the Blazers, and the injuries stopped that from happening. And then, as we all know, Wesley got hurt, and then everything went downhill. But I think that's O'Shea's vision, if I had to guess.
It is for the long term. Do you think CJ is more of the super sub, kind of sixth man type? Maybe a Lou Williams with a better shot selection, or Jamal Crawford, not such a gunner, kind of type sixth man off the bench. Is that what you're saying that Neil O'Shea might be envisioning, or do you think that sixth man is a different player who could come in and be that for the Blazers?
I think it's an either-or proposition, and I think the great thing is that we're going to have another 60 games or 58 games or whatever to find out what role CJ is capable of filling, and I think we just don't know at this point. The one thing that gives me pause to immediately label him as a Mo Williams or Lou Williams or Jamal Crawford type player is that his facilitation has been great, actually. He's done a really good job of finding open teammates. Mike Richmond had an interesting tweet today about the improved shooting performance of the other players around him when he's on the court. And I think that he is finding other guys in the pick and roll, for instance, and he's doing a lot to make sure that Allen Crabbe is still getting open shots or that Al-Farouq Aminu is still getting open shots. And to me, that says that he has the potential, if he can combine this improved playmaking ability with an improved shot selection or an improved ability to make the shot in less than ideal circumstances, he has the potential to become a legitimate starting guard and not just a scoring six man off the bench.
Let's talk about a couple of the other starters, and you alluded to Al-Farouq Aminu in your last response there. How are these guys playing for you? We've talked a lot about the backcourt, and I guess we could talk about the defense and stuff like that, but I want to talk about a couple of the other guys here. So like Al-Farouq Aminu, he started out the season really hot, and lately it seems like his shooting is kind of regressed a little bit closer to the mean, kind of what we expected prior to the season. I guess a little more in line with his career averages. How do you like Al-Farouq Aminu so far? I guess 23 games in the season. Now that we have kind of a large enough sample size to get past that early season kind of breakout that he had for Blazer fans. Now that he's regressed a little, what do you make of Al-Farouq Aminu so far?
I think it's a question of what our expectations of Al-Farouq Aminu are, or any player like him on the team right now. And if the question is, should he be the starting small forward for the foreseeable future for this entire 4-year contract, then you have to start to worry just a little bit. He was hitting three-pointers at the beginning of the season. He was looking real good with that. And then I haven't looked at the numbers with this, but my eye test is that defenses have adjusted and started closing out on him more quickly and realized that, hey, if we leave Aminu wide open, he's going to hit some shots. And so I think what we've seen is some defensive adjustment. And again, that's just an eye test, so I hope the numbers will bear that out. But I think you have to start to be aware with Aminu that he has some pretty obvious weaknesses and he has some pretty obvious strengths. Paul George did very poorly against him, which is a testament to his defensive skill, given how well George has been playing. So if you want to send someone out who's going to be that Wes Matthews-style stopper and do anything it takes to hound Paul George all day, if you want to send someone out who can get out in the open court and really run, you send out Aminu. If you want to send out someone who's going to make no mistakes, who's not going to try to over-dribble or make a bad decision when he has the ball, then you probably want to send out Allen Crabbe. So I think we have to be very aware of the situational limitations that a lot of these guys outside of Damian Lillard have.
Man, that was put pretty eloquently there. You mentioned Al-Farouq Aminu a little bit. It seems, in his kind of the good and the bad that comes with him. I think, if you look at a guy like Ed Davis, and I think this is kind of the book on him. We've been talking about this. There's a lot of articles over the summer about this. The first 4 or 5 years of his career, he hadn't necessarily found his niche, or he hadn't found his lane and stayed in it. He was kind of still attempting mid-range jumpers, kind of drifting out of the paint where his real strength lies. And then last season with the Lakers, he said, "This is what I'm good at, is getting offensive rebounds, getting those second chance points, creating second chance points for my teammates, keeping possessions alive, making the opposing defense work hard to get stops and get rebounds." And he hardly drifted outside of the paint at all. And he ended up being, if he had shot enough times, he would have been, I think it was number one or number two in the NBA in terms of field goal percentage. And it's something in the mid to upper 90s of his shots were coming within, I think, 3 feet of the paint. Do you think this is kind of an attitude that Aminu could kind of take on, where he says, I'm this crazy long defender who can hound opposing offenses, who can get in the passing lanes and create turnovers, and can get out on the fast break a little bit, but on offense, kind of wait to get that open shot as opposed to trying to take a guy off the dribble? I mean, it's kind of stressful, I think, as a Blazer fan, watching Al-Farouq Aminu try to create off the dribble. It kind of reminds you of Chris Kaman last year when he tried to put the spin move on somebody. It's kind of flashbacks of that sometimes when Al-Farouq Aminu decides to go crazy with the ball. Do you think that's just who he is as a player, or do you think he could maybe take on a little bit more of that Ed Davis kind of attitude and stay in his lane and just be good at what he's good at?
Well, he's here for 4 years, so I sure hope he does.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's I think that's on the coaching staff, but beyond that, I also think it's easier for him to do that right now, because as the theme of this podcast is that everyone outside of Lillard has a limitation, and everyone outside of Lillard can only do so much. And so I think if Aminu, you know, put him on a playoff team where he's the fifth starter, where the other four starters are highly capable, and I think maybe he would start to see, oh, you know what, I'm the fifth option on offense. I'm going to go do the stand in the corner and nail the three-pointer thing, and then my attention is going to be when I totally shut down Paul George, or, you know, knock the heck out of James Harden so that he can't keep scoring for the rest of the game. And I'm hoping that that psychological effect would happen when it's clear that he's no longer the third scorer on a team like he has been often for the Blazers.
Do you think Aminu would be the type of guy who could just wreak havoc on opposing second units if he were to be replaced in the starting lineup? And I'm not going to throw out who I think could potentially be there, because there's a couple guys on the team, so I don't want to throw my hat behind anybody on that. But
They could shift Myers to three, right?
I mean, you know, I have heard the suggestion before. I've heard the suggestion that Vonleh should be shoehorned into the three position too.
I don't know. Neither of those options would go well.
I don't want to throw out a straw man there, because I don't think that's a prevailing opinion by Blazer fans, but I have heard it.
Yeah, I've seen it around too, yeah.
But do you, hypothetically speaking, and we won't talk about who starts in place of Aminu, because there's a couple of different guys, and we've already talked about a lot about the strengths and weaknesses of some of those bench players. But do you think Aminu is just really one of those kind of guys that could wreak havoc on opposing second units?
Yeah, he definitely is. I'd be a little bit hesitant to do that, only because he's such a good defender, and he has shown that he is able to match up well with marquee players. One thing, though, that would, I think, work really well with him on a second unit is his versatility. He's big enough to play the four. He's quick enough to hang with the small forwards. And so when other teams start to throw out their funky second units or their small ball lineups, or maybe they throw out a Twin Towers unit, I think he would be very adaptable to quirky things that other coaches do to try to create some matchup problems for the Blazers. And having a multi-positionality aspect to your game is really important in the NBA right now, since especially teams like Portland and Dallas run their players on offense into any position where they can, you know, any position where they can fit at all. And so being able to match up with two or three guys is a key thing, and that definitely gives him some benefits to coming off the bench, I think.
What do you make of the front court rotation as it currently stands? We know that Myers Leonard has been back healthy for a number of games, and he's not been reinserted into the starting lineup, permanently. We don't know if it's going to stay that way or not, but you have Ed Davis, Mason Plumlee, Noah Vonleh, Myers Leonard, and then you have Aminu and Harkless, I believe, playing a little bit of small ball as well. Do you like how the front court rotation is working right now, or do you think there's any tweaks or improvements that could be made from what you're seeing on the court right now?
The biggest thing I've noticed is how Ed Davis and Mason Plumlee aren't a total disaster together when they're on the court, which kind of surprised me, because on paper they seem like they're too similar and too incapable of, you know, doing anything outside of the paint. So that's really surprised me with that. Beyond that, I think the Blazers are not a team that can dictate what the opposition is going to do. So I think they have to do a lot of adjusting. And so I think having flexibility on a night-to-night basis is important. And it seems like the front court allows that to a certain extent. And hopefully Terry Stotts can keep finding lineups that work well against certain matchups against other teams.
How much has Ed Davis impressed you this season? Is he exceeding your expectations, or was this kind of what you were expecting from Ed Davis coming into the season? Because he's been playing with a lot of passion, a lot of heart lately, and he's been, I think, one of the main reasons. I think, you know, obviously Damian Lillard, CJ McCollum are incredibly important for their scoring, as is Myers Leonard and a number of other players. Crabbe's been playing really well as of late too, but I think, you know, Ed Davis sometimes kind of sets the tone with his energy and with his hustle and his defense and the kind of intangibles that he brings to the court. So are you particularly impressed by him right now? Do you like what Ed Davis is doing? Do you think he's earned himself any more minutes, or what do you make of Ed Davis at this point, 23 games into the Blazers season?
You know, I admitted on our editorial chat for Blazers Edge the other day that you and Brandon had converted me on Brandon Goldner, the social media editor, had converted me on Alan Crabb, and I was on board with Crabb getting more minutes now. And you know, it's hard for me to admit that, but it's you can't deny it. Ed Davis, I'm still a little bit skeptical on. He's obviously performing very well, and he's putting up some great numbers. And he's bringing exactly what the Blazers knew he would bring when they signed him from LA. The reason I'm a little bit skeptical is because he fits the mold of, I think this was a term that was popular in the 90s in the NBA, but it still applies to Ed Davis, is he's a garbage man. And what that means is that he cleans up the messes in the game that no one else is going to go after, because he's so aggressive and he's so tenacious that whenever there's a loose ball, he's going to grab it. Whenever there's a rebound to be grabbed, he's going to take advantage of it. And he maximizes kind of chaotic situations and turns them into points and rebounds. And you absolutely need players like that on your team. They're great for the second unit. You can send them out there and say, you know what, go grab every single rebound. They can be really useful going down the stretch if you have a, you know, four other guys you trust to who can create points. You can use him to make sure that the other team is always going to have someone boxed out. You know, he's always going to be there to push Dwight Howard off away from the rebounding position. But in the long run, you have to start to wonder if that role is something that you need to use a roster spot on, and I think it probably is. But I don't think that role is something that is going to get you significantly more minutes. I think it's something that's going to get you spot minutes, and it's going to get you minutes when that role is needed.
I think in the short term, you know, and Brandon said this on the podcast last week. You mentioned Brandon Goldner, our social media editor. Blazers Edge, but you know, he said that you have kind of Damian Lillard, this superstar, and I'm just going to paraphrase here, but you have a number of kind of, you know, if we're playing NBA 2K, right, you'd have, you know, a number of B-, maybe C-plus players, and then there's, you know, there's some guys at the end of the bench that are below that, but it's pretty much Damian and a bunch of average to above average NBA players, right? And so with the kind of talent that the Blazers are bringing to the court every night, if they're going to play a team that has significantly more talent than them, those second chance points are going to be the way that's what's going to swing a game in their favor. It's going to be taking advantage of that hustle, right? It's going to be taking advantage of other teams maybe sleeping on them. And Ed Davis bringing that kind of energy, I think, is able to take advantage of teams that maybe underestimate the Blazers and their talent level. So certainly, I think personally in the short term, it's really important to have a guy like Ed Davis out there, you know, to kind of, you know, get your team extra possessions, to extend possessions for your team, to disrupt the opposing offense with his, you know, you mentioned his tenacity on defense. You know, these are the kind of things that a young team with maybe, you know, less talent than playoff teams in the West, they're going to need to capitalize on things like the second chance points that are created by a guy, you know, like Ed Davis and Mason Plumlee to a certain extent as well. I mean, in the long term, though, I think it'd be great to have a guy like that off the bench, you know, in what, 16, 20 minutes a night, right?
Yeah, and I think maybe I undersold how important he could be. But I think it's important to temper your expectations. And I think 16 to 20 minutes a night is exactly right for someone like that. You have to recognize what his limitations are, and you send him in with the bench unit for some. He's the energy guy. He's not a Thomas Robinson style energy. It's a very different style energy. But he's going to go out there and he's going to get those points and rebounds with the second unit for you. But you have to know that he's not probably going to develop into anything beyond that. He's not going to be someone that a playoff team is going to be starting 82 games a year, or that is going to earn 30 minutes a night on a 50-win team. And so I think that in the short term, he's more important to the Blazers now than he will be in hopefully 2 or 3 years. But that doesn't mean that he doesn't have a role on the Blazers in 2 or 3 years.
So 23 games into the season, I think it's just over a quarter of the season. So it's, you know, the Warriors still haven't lost yet, which is absolutely bonkers. But
don't say that. They haven't played the Friday game yet.
Knock on wood, we're recording this on Thursday, so we're assuming that the Warriors, they play the Celtics Friday, is it right?
That's right.
We're assuming that they're going to beat the Celtics, and I guess real quick, you're going to be at that game, right?
We'll see. I'm looking at the tickets right now. We'll see if it's worth it.
Oh, dude. Well, if you can afford to get into the building, that's got to be the team to watch. I'm That's a historical team right now.
Yeah.
Absolutely insane what they're doing. But back to the Blazers, I mean, 23 games into the season, we had such a wild offseason, and with Blazers Edge expanding our coverage significantly over the last several months, and in particular over this past offseason, we had so much coverage coming out. We had so many voices talking about so many different things, talking about, we had all these new players to talk about and all the old players who left, and so many unknowns and so many variables. And there were so many, I remember so many times saying, if this, then this, if that, then that. It was kind of, you're basically left to pretty much speculation for the better part of the summer, other than knowing what Damian Lillard would bring to the court. Pretty much everything else was an unknown. So I guess, Eric, we'll wrap this podcast. I want to ask you, this season, 23 games in, just over a quarter into the season, is there anybody on the Blazers who doesn't look like a good fit so far for you, or just you don't assume is going to be a long-term piece? I know Chris Kamen would be the obvious answer, Gerald Henderson as well, but is there anybody else maybe on that bench that doesn't look to be as long-term of an asset as we thought, or as good of a fit as we thought? And likewise, on the other side of the coin, is there anybody we haven't talked about yet on this podcast that has surprised you a little bit, that maybe you didn't expect to be as much of a contributor, who's actually stepping up his game?
I think that's a really difficult question, because it depends on what you're trying to do with each individual player. And so someone like Ed Davis, he could have a role in the future. He, you know, like we were saying, he fills a very particular niche, and you know what he's going to bring every day. Once you start to get into the other players on the team, though, I think there is still a very open question in what they could become for the team and what they could bring. I wrote a brief 2-paragraph piece on Mason Plumlee earlier in the week, and I kind of cherry-picked out some defensive plays he made against the Milwaukee Bucks. And my point was, hey, look, this guy has the athleticism. He can jump pretty freaking high. He blocked Michael Carter Williams at the apex of a dunk attempt in the open court. That's awesome for a center. And then he also made some really good rotations in that game, and he's made some great weak side help decisions in the last couple weeks for the team. And so even though Mason Plumlee is a terrible defender for the most part, you know, he can't stop a guy one-on-one in the post, he's going to get torn up by someone like Greg Monroe, he has potential. He has the building blocks to become a better defender, especially a better weak side defender and a better defender in the open court. And so with someone like that who doesn't fit at the moment, and I think it's safe to say he doesn't fit as a starting center for what the Blazers need right now, you have to ask, though, could he develop that defensive skill? Could he, by the end of the season, become a player who could be part of the rotation and fill a key role? And so I think it's more important right now, rather than saying who doesn't fit, to look at the potential skills players have and say, what skill do they need to develop to fit with the team? And Mason Plumlee would be the example. He could develop his defense to the point that he becomes a serviceable starting center, which would save the Blazers a crap ton of money in the offseason, presumably.
Right. He's on the books for, what, 1.2 this year and just over that next season. Is that right on Mason Plumlee?
Something absurdly low like that, yeah.
Yeah, on that rookie deal, he was a late first-round pick, I think. So that rookie deal is going to come in handy. And a number of these players are still on their rookie deals. We mentioned this on the podcast last week, but that has affected the Blazers' payroll being so low. And we know that Damian's his contract extension is going to kick in, and he's going to be taking up some along the lines of $20 million of that cap space. So there's a number of guys who are making not a ton of money in terms of NBA standards and in terms of where NBA contracts are going to go. And Mason Plumlee is a really good example of a guy who's certainly outperforming his contract and would be, I think, a huge value, you just mentioned, you know, for the Blazers to keep him in the future, should they be able to bolster that front court a little bit. And maybe he could, you know, maybe specialize in a few different things instead of having to be a starter where you have to be kind of, it doesn't help to be one-dimensional at all, obviously. As a starter, you kind of need to be able to do multiple things generally.
But you need a niche that you fill. And so right. Mason Plumlee, let's say we're trying to find niches for him to fill on the defensive end. He's never going to be the post-up defender, most likely. He's not going to be that guy. Maybe Myers-Leonard could be, who knows. But he has the potential and the athleticism to become the weak side help defender who chases a power forward around and then comes over and rejects the guard when they sneak around Damian. And so I think it's important to see that potential in the guys who are on the team right now and figure out whether or not there's a niche they could fill and if that's actually going to happen or not.
There's so much too. I mean, I kept saying 23 games in the season as if that was a huge sample size. We still have, 59 games left to go this season. I mean, if you look at Mo Harkless, an example of a guy, if you look at him last season, the way everything was up and down for him, I mean, there could be an injury and he could be getting suddenly more minutes, or Stotts could be putting him in a stretch lineup potentially. He could find some kind of a niche, a guy like Harkless playing stretch four or something. He could find, a way to affect the team and opposing defenses the way that he hadn't, heretofore in the season. So
he's been really interesting because I feel like he's just like, he started out really strong and then he's just, it's like I haven't noticed him on the court for 2 weeks. It's been really weird.
I feel the same way. And that's kind of why I brought him up. It's just like, I wonder, because you heard all these preseason accolades that he was earning in training camp, not only from his teammates, but from the coaching staff and reporters as well, talking about how impressive he was in training camp with the Trailblazers. And we know that, this is, to a certain degree, there's always going to be a training camp all-star who just doesn't pan out in the regular season. That's not something that's never happened before in the NBA. Most Blazer fans are probably familiar with that. At any rate, you hear those kind of things and you just wonder when you're going to be able to see him put it all together for 5-6 games at a time. And so far we haven't seen that out of him, right?
No, absolutely not. And you do see flashes of what they were talking about in training camp, especially the athleticism. But I don't think it's translated well so far. And so we'll have to wait and see. But again, he was another player who was acquired for literally nothing. So you're not going to bat 1,000. And if he doesn't pan out, it's not the end of the world. It's not going to make or break the rebuild.
Yeah, man, we've pretty much covered it all today. We talked about CJ and Damian, talked a little bit about the front court, talked about Aminu. We even got on to talking about Mo Harkless, man. So,
I forgot about him, so I'm glad you brought him up at the end. Sorry, Mo.
No, I think I say this every podcast, but I'm so happy to have so many different things to talk about with this team. There's just always one thing always leads to another. It can be kind of frustrating sometimes where, like I said earlier, you have a lot of if this, then that. And that's certainly the case with a young rebuilding team, but geez, I mean, when you're talking about a guy that you acquired for a protected second rounder over the summer, when he's a legitimate topic of conversation, when a guy like AC is a legitimate topic of conversation, that's what kind of gets me excited to watch a rebuilding team like the Blazers.
Yeah, I agree, but I don't want to be doing this in 3 years.
Exactly. So hopefully the team follows Damian Lillard in suit and they get a couple of other, a couple of these guys rise to the occasion, and maybe Olshea will bring in a couple of other guys to help off the bench, and we'll have that to talk about in the future. But Eric, I'm going to have to let you go today, man. I really appreciate you coming on the show, man. I think this is your fourth time this season coming on the Weekend Podcast, right?
I think so, yeah.
Man, so that makes you, along with a number of other Blazers Edge staffers, a regular, so Blazers Edge listeners can look forward to hearing you again on the podcast. I'm assuming it's going to be sometime in the next 5 or 6 weeks. We got episode 100 coming up in a couple weeks. That's going to be...
You got anything special planned for that?
That's what I was going to throw to you. Did you have any ideas, or...
I don't know. I'm always into the Blazers history, so I'd love 5 or 10 minutes of talking about the greatest moments of the last 10 years or something, or since the podcast started, or anything like that.
If it's me, there's going to be, and listeners who listen to the show regularly are going to know that it's going to be very heavy on the 05, 06, 06, 07 seasons. I love the trivia of guys like Sergei Monia talking about Ha Sung-jin, Sergei Monia, guys like that. Ime Udoka, he's one of my favorite players. So
Kriapa.
Oh, man. Well, Kriapa is what netted the Blazers LaMarcus Aldridge. He was the linchpin in that trade to the Chicago Bulls. So he plays a very important role in the history of the Blazers franchise.
Yep.
But at any rate, there's so much to talk about. And you know, with episode 100 coming up, I guess I could turn this to the listeners as well. If you have any suggestions, that's going to be coming up in 2 weeks. So email us at blazersedgepodcast@gmail.com. But until then, Eric, where can Blazers Edge listeners find you on Twitter?
Yeah, I'm at Deering Tornado, which is a shout out to the teen comedy Hang Time from NBC from back in the 90s, if anyone else remembers that. And then I'm on Blazers Edge under my name, Eric Griffith, and I write on Wednesdays or Thursdays, depending on when there's room to run the column. And then I also write some game previews.
Man, that is an obscure reference on the on the 90s Hang Time show. So if anybody remembers that, hit up Eric on Twitter and remind him. But hey, thanks for coming on again, man. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, you too. Have a good night.
And that'll do it for episode 96 of the Blazers Edge podcast. I'd like to thank you very much for joining us today, and I'd also like to thank Blazers Edge staff writer Eric Griffith for coming on the show. If you like the intro or outro music for this week's episode, that was provided by local beatmaker and producer Odar. You can hear more of his work at soundcloud.com/odarbeats. Make sure and tune in to the Blazers Edge podcast early next week to hear Phil Nason's and Dave Deckard. I'm Chris Lucia, and I will be back in a couple of weeks because Tara and Joe will be filling in for me next weekend on episode 98 of the Blazers Edge podcast.